meeting will come to order. We do have a quorum. And let's see, Representative Sundin, would you like to move the approval of the minutes for yesterday? Okay.
Nelson's instructed.
Okay, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay, the minutes are approved. We'll go forward from where we left yesterday. Representative Earhart, would you like to start?
Madam Chair, I think we just finished up the presentation on from MnDOT, and we're on to the next testifier, which would be Dennis Flattery. Am I correct?
That's what we have.
Okay.
Mr. Flaherty?
Oh, I think that's Dan. Is it yours?
Welcome to the committee. If you'll identify yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Dennis Flaherty, and I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, which is a association that represents rank and file police officers throughout our state that work for all levels of government, city, county, and the state itself. I also have a handout that I'd like to see if I could get distributed. I am here today to speak in opposition not to the bill, but to just the section of the bill. Specifically, Section 8, which deals with the automatic speed enforcement, or what affectionately is called photocop. And I would like to limit my remarks to that section, if I could. Members, all across our country, states and municipalities are attracted to the use of cameras in traffic enforcement, largely due to the promise of reduced crashes and increased revenue from the issuance of citations. These programs create more ill will toward police than almost any other single enforcement effort there might be. The ill will is not towards the government officials that rally for the use of cameras, but instead at the police, because it's the police mailing the ticket to them. The perception of revenue-driven enforcement is detested by the public. In San Diego, the court threw out the use of camera enforcement, citing, quote, lack of oversight and the method of compensation made evidence from cameras so untrustworthy and unreliable that it should not be admitted. In Arizona, they decided not to renew their contract with the camera vendor following a study of their 76 statewide photo enforcement efforts, citing, quote, less than expected revenues, mixed public acceptance, and mixed data. And in Edmonton, Alberta canceled all 100,000 tickets issued by their photocop program due to concerns over reliability. Nothing can substitute having direct contact, in this case, direct contact with a trooper, to correct driving behavior. Whether that means they issue a ticket, a written warning, or just a strong verbal warning, there is no substitution for that. Plus, only a trooper stopping a car can arrest motorists that have no license or have no auto insurance or might have a outstanding warrant for their arrest. Cameras cannot replace that value to our state. Instead, we're going to go to a system where a trooper is going to find out who the registered owner of the vehicle is, run their driver's license, and if the camera photo is close to that on the driver's license of the registered owner, a citation would be sent to the owner at the address on the license. Whether they live there or not, it's going to be sent there. If it's a correct address, assume the citation is received. If it isn't, assume it was not. This is an important element because tickets not paid can and do turn into license suspensions. Warrants are issued. So someone issued a ticket through a photocop program could easily find themselves arrested and their cars impounded when they never realized they were even cited. When a trooper hands you a citation and you fail to take action, then you become responsible for whatever action develops. Members, I would submit this is not the direction as a state that we should go. This is not who we are as a state. This is not who our troopers and our police officers want to be, and most important, it's not what our citizens want from their law enforcement community. Traffic enforcement must be left to the discretion of police officers. Technology, as advanced as it may be, should not be relied on in this area of enforcement. I have sent a letter that was written by the president of the Troopers Association. He was here yesterday, prepared to testify against Section 8, and unfortunately couldn't be here. So that is his letter, which I think speaks for itself about their opposition to photocop enforcement. I think, lastly, I would just like to point out, work zone safety is a very serious subject, and I applaud folks that are trying to put some things in place that can make these zones safer. But what you're doing here is creating a $300 ticket and then adding on about another $75 in court costs, yet you're not putting it on their record. If it's that serious or egregious of offense, I'm just wondering why we would want to use photocop. I think we'd want to be extra careful here to make sure that the person that's violating and that's speeding through a work zone actually is stopped and given a ticket, rather than just hoping that a ticket can be issued by a trooper at some office in the state and hope that it goes to the right person. What seemed to me that it's counter to what the supporters are really trying to accomplish here on behalf of men and women that work on our roads today. With that, I would just close by asking you to remove Section 8 from what otherwise I think is a good bill. And I'd be glad to stand for any questions.
Representative Runda.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just wanted to ask, I forgot your last name, I'm sorry.
Flaherty.
Flaherty, of course, Mr. Flaherty. All right, so when you have a work zone, which presumably is one or two lanes without any shoulders, okay, how does a law enforcement person in a car then actually catch the driver speeding? I mean, where do they observe the driver from? And
either
is this ticket issued?
Madam Chair, Representative Runback, either I note that they're either at the beginning of the work zone, parked stationary, which, by the way, in and of itself has a great reducing effect on speed, but they're working radar as you enter it or as you leave it, one or the other. Typically, while you're entering, they have your speed as you're entering the zone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And
Representative Brown.
I'm just thinking of, say, the recent work zone on 694. Just really never see cops along there. But, I mean, it just seems to me it's an unlikely place to find somebody, you know, physically there with a car catching speeders.
Madam Chair, Representative Runbeck, I'm not familiar with that zone. I'm more familiar with the Lafayette Bridge, and every time I've passed that in the last year, there's always a trooper there, whether it's on a weekday, a Saturday, or a Sunday. So I don't know if you're just not passing it at the right time, but the State Patrol does work these work zones very, very heavily.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Flaherty, I just have a quick question. I remember the long discussion and debate that we had a year ago about this photocop, and I think I expressed my concerns with it then. But I just want to be sure that as we move forward, if Section 8 is removed from the bill, would you support the bill?
Madam Chair, yes, Representative, I would.
Good. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Representative Earhart, do you want to move your bill, or do we want to take testimony from the audience at this point? Oh, I'm sorry. Christy Sebastian from Dakota County, is she here? Welcome, and please identify yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee. I am Christy Sebastian. I'm the traffic engineer for Dakota County, and I am here today representing the Minnesota County Engineers Association as a representative on our Highway Safety Committee. I'm here today to discuss some concerns regarding this House File 1796 and the proposed amendment regarding the work zone speed limit, which is before you today. The county is committed to improving safety on our county highway system and is engaged in the Toward Zero Death Initiative. Development of the county highway safety plans, one element that we have done, and establishing our Highway Safety Committee. These efforts, along with others, has resulted in a decrease in overall fatal crashes each year. It's important to note that a large portion of rural roadway collisions occur on the county road system, including 41% of the fatal collisions and 33% of all injury crashes. Speed is a significant factor in the collisions. Speed is cited as a contributing factor in 21% of all fatal collisions system-wide. Safety overall and safety of workers conducting construction or maintenance activities along our highway is a priority of the County Engineers Association. First, I'd like to thank the committee for being concerned with work zone safety, but we do have some concerns regarding one element of the bill that I'd like to raise. It deals with that the county highways are very different in characteristics from one roadway to the next. And the term work zone is a broad term that is used to define any instances when work is being conducted on the roadway, from major reconstruction to maintenance work addressing a traffic signal, pavement marking operation, a mobile operation, cleaning a storm sewer, or utility work. It's important that signing for work zones be effective for the field conditions present to ensure maximum worker safety and to meet driver compliance when a speed reduction is necessary and present. Brought today the Work Zone Traffic Control Field Manual. Just as a guide, this is the document that we use in work zones to set up what's happening for whatever given condition we have. And as you can see, it's a very large document just denoting that the roadway conditions, the type of work, and the highways that we're looking at can be diverse and require very different setups depending on how long a work zone might be going on and what's being done. So in consideration of that, it's important to note that major reconstruction or maintenance work really needs different conditions. So essentially, the one-size-fits-all approach to the speed reduction is where we're most concerned, that the roadways look very different, our maintenance and construction activities go on for different time frames, they're done on different roadways. So one-size-fits-all approach to work zone safety does not work well and may not be effective for all kinds of work. For example, workers painting pavement messages such as a stop ahead and arrows is a mobile operation since crews are in one place for a short time and then move on. Likewise, utility companies working on a manhole alongside the roadway constitutes a work zone as well. Again, a very different type of operation. So having a speed reduction amendment, which would require maintenance crews and the moving operation utility companies to all post a speed zone reduction, would be a cumbersome activity and also may not actually meet drivers' thoughts that this would be that type of work zone that would need a speed reduction and therefore may not meet driver expectation and see people actually slowing down. Further, it would provide no additional safety buffer above and beyond what the cones, barrels, flashing lights, and safety vests already provide for these type of examples that I'm raising. it is not likely that this type of operation would gain motor compliance with signs, and adding this element to the work zone setup is challenging. Contrasting this with major construction projects requiring workers to be alongside the roadway for a long period of time with high traffic volumes traveling by, these type of roadways often do have work zone reductions, and their use is applicable and needed. But is it appropriate that the work zone be exactly 15 miles an hour less than the posted speed? It may actually need to be lower in some instances. The message the county engineers would like to share is that what may be appropriate speed for one work zone on one roadway or one particular setup may not be in another. Engineering judgment is at the foreground of the decision process and the conditions being occurring to make the right decision on what the reduction may be or if a speed reduction is applicable. So I'd like to close by emphasizing that the County Engineer Association supports much of the bill, including increased fines in work zones, increased enforcement to address speeding, prohibition of cell phones, and reduced speeds in work zones when appropriate. However, we believe that legislation to dictate the speed reduction in this one-size-fits-all manner is not the best manner to actually reduce speeds and increase safety. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Okay. Representative Earhart, then.
Thank you. Well, first I'd like to move an amendment here, H1796A5. And what this does is remove the cell phone language. I think that Flaherty has made good points, and rather than destroy the whole effort here, we should probably acquiesce to his suggestion that we not keep this in the bill.
Okay. I think we may have some confusion. Mr. Burris, would you like to clarify?
Madam Chair and members, this amendment would remove the automated enforcement.
Oh, did I say cell phones? Sorry. Excuse me.
Okay.
So,
okay,
the
so
clarified amendment. I put that up for anybody have any. That I make that, or whatever the current language is, I recommend.
Okay.
That we remove the language covering the
are there
automated
any
equipment.
Are there any questions on the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Okay, we now. Okay, now we can discuss the bill as amended. Are there questions now? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Earhart, we've all heard about this this cell phone usage in traffic zones for a long time, and when it comes down to safety, there isn't anybody in this room that would say that they're against safety or anything to increase or enhance safety. But the one thing I've been following in the news, and it's become hyped up a lot in the years, is this use of cell phones in a car. I'm a pilot. I multitask every day I'm in the air. There's people that can do it. There's people that cannot do it. I look at these cell phones. I can drive down the highway and I can say to anybody in my vehicle, hey, look, what do you think that person's doing next to us? When they're out with their head down, punching a phone. What are they doing? Well, they're texting. I said, how do you know they're not calling their mother because their brother just died? They're dialing the telephone. You don't know. And really, the issue here is basically distracted driving. But somebody just wants to isolate a cell phone. What do you say to all the truckers out there if they still use that lingo, Breaker 19? Is it going to be outlawed for them to reach down and grab their CB microphone when they're going through a work zone? I'm driving my car down through a work zone. I got my window open. A bee flies in. I don't know how many catchy phrases for if a bee flies in, and I got to swat a bee. Nothing rhymes with cone. But there's so many instances of distracted driving, especially here in the urban area. Out in the rural area, I've never seen anybody shaving. But in the metro here, I see people shaving when they're going down the road. I do not see Norelco's listed here on this bill. There's so many things that could be added to this bill, but it's not summed up. And that summary is distracted driving. For some reason, the cell phone is just this incredibly dangerous tool. I would love to see that whole thing just absolutely rewritten to say, if you are convicted of distracted driving, then you have a case. And the other side of this coin is this fine. I know I mentioned this a little bit earlier, but I truly believe that if the fine was $3,000, there'd be people that still would vote for this. And a lot of these fines are basically money makers. If you looked at this bill and said, strike out the $300 fine, and you impose, let's say, 100 hours of community service, would this bill have the same effect? Maybe, maybe not. I know people that could, $300, big deal. Just pay the fine. I'm finding a lot of things that I have a problem with this bill. And it's not because I'm against safety, but there's so many underlying things that are being left out of this bill. And that I just wanted to voice my concern about that, because the main thing is distracted driving. And when I brought this up yesterday, the two incidences that were brought up on 35W, neither one of those unfortunate accidents had anything to do with a cell phone. But yet that seems to be a major player here. I just kind of find that kind of misplaced. Thank you.
Well,
Representative Earhart.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, and there are many, many things that can be placed under the category of distracted driving. We know that. For instance, you put your makeup on when you're coming down the road. That's a distraction. In the mirror, instead of looking, putting your eyeshadow and stuff on, you do that? That's distracted driving.
No.
Mr. Werke, have you got the list of, we had a listing, which I don't seem to find in this pile here, of how many, it came out of AGC's national efforts, and it showed what percentage I think it was 21% of all accidents of the million or 2-3 million were caused by cell phone use, which was the major cause. And I don't have that. Yeah, it was. Anyway, it was a very high percentage, and we were looking for that right now. It is probably the leading distraction. I don't know where it is, but yeah, I know that, but well, I don't know where it is. I think it was in the packet originally. But a high percentage of, and it was quoting well over a million accidents, and I think 21% were caused by cell phone use. And it is one of the big distractions because you're not, or and it gives the seconds that you normally use your cell phone for to dial up a number or whatever. And in that time, it gave the travel time of a vehicle going 60 miles an hour. And that's enormous. I think it was like two football fields at 60 miles an hour in the 6 seconds or 7 seconds or whatever it takes you to dial a number. And it talks about the cause. So I don't know if anybody's got that or seen it, but I was reading about it, and I don't know where it is now. So I think we, by landing on the cell phone idea, I think we are landing on one of the chief causes of it. We also know, of course, that many states have, not many, but at least 12 states have been handheld cell phones. And novice drivers are restricted in 37 states from the use of cell phones. Text messaging is banned for all drivers in 41 states. And all of this is due to the fact that they are the really fat distraction that takes your eyes off the road. I mean, you may eat a hamburger or reach for a french fry or look at a pretty girl walking down the street, but you're not taking the time of concentration that you are when you're working with your cell phone. Now, you may not look at pretty girls, but whatever you look at, when you're putting your makeup on, you wouldn't be doing that. I'm kidding you.
If I can interject, I think around 2009, 2010, I did have a bill that prohibited the use of cell phones. And it was also the same year that we were dealing with the breathalyzer, so the AAA and the Safety Council didn't have enough resources to support, to do everything that year, so we let that drop. But with the thought is that we would come back and do a total distracted driving package someday. And in the meantime, they said they would be working on statistics to back that up. So that helps.
I appreciate that, Madam Chair, as well as Representative Earhart. And to me, that is the ultimate, to be able to convict somebody under distracted driving. Because, again, there are people that can multitask when they're driving. The other day, I'm going down the highway. I see a highway patrol on the phone while he's on his computer and driving. I thought, this is my kind of guy. He should be a pilot. Not everybody can do it, and that's my point. But just this whole thing right in this bill of isolating the cell phone on its own, to me, I have a lot of problems with that. Representative Earhart brought up eating, going down the highway. Every one of us in this room is guilty of that. Oh, Mike, come on. You know, but there's so many things. What if you've got kids in the back? Are we going to have to put up those plexiglass like they have in the limousine so you can't reach back and swat your kids? You know, there's so many different examples of soundproof. I like that, too. There's so many examples of distracted driving, and that's really the issue. Not a cell phone.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Swatsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I would just like to say that Dunick Construction in West Central Minnesota firmly supports no cell phones in work areas. To your point, Representative, if I may, I'm not so sure if there's so many concrete barriers up in the sky where you have very little shoulder or barriers that you can bump off of when you're in an airplane versus a car. So I guess the people that are working in this industry probably feel the danger more than I do day to day as I'm driving in the car. And actually, a gentleman at the county fair came to me with this exact bill. Could you please take up a bill for no cell phones in work construction areas? That's it. Work construction, whether it's 20 yards, 2 miles, people are feeling threatened, people are dying. And I do know that maybe right now, the statistics aren't available to at our fingertips about how many have died in work zones across the United States. I hope that we can find that. But I do know that our teenagers or adults are having car accidents in good conditions due to cell phones. I'm not going to go so far as to talk about taking cell phones away from everybody on the road. But I do know that if my constituent are supporting this, I need to say for the record that I would like to see cell phone ban use in work zone areas. And I think that we can make our phone calls prior to getting home. We're going to be a little late, honey, because there's a work zone coming up and I can't text you or talk to you in the next couple of miles. Texting is already illegal, I believe. So I've been thinking about this a lot over the last couple of nights, and I thinking about other accidents that do happen that we do have records of that people are dying on the roads due to distracted driving, due to cell phones. And so that's I just have to say that for the record.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I strongly support this bill. Thank you, Representative Earhart, for bringing it forward, Mr. Werke. And I'll just say what I said during our interim hearing, and I've done a lot of research on this, and I do think, Representative Swatsky, we should move in the direction of a full cell phone ban. However, this is an incremental step. Representative Anderson, you're correct. We have to address this comprehensively. There's other distractions. I've worked with Minnesotans for Safe Driving and others on this Department of Public Safety. We have made some progress on this in terms of at least getting some draft language a few years ago, so I definitely want to work with you on it. But this is an incremental step forward, and I'll say to the committee what I said, you know, when we first heard this, which is it's indisputable, the evidence, the studies, this is the equivalent of 0.08. This is the equivalent of driving drunk. And so we wouldn't want people driving drunk anywhere, let alone work areas. But that's what the science says. That's what the data says. When you talk on a cell phone, whether it's handheld or not, or hands-free, you're the equivalent of a drunk driver. And so we'll be preventing a lot of accidents, not only in work zones, but hopefully eventually everywhere. People should not be texting. That is the law. But they shouldn't be talking on the phone either. So a very good bill, Representative Earhart, and I hope we can all support this.
Thank you, Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I guess it's the idea of incrementalism I want to talk to that my colleague just mentioned. You know, if we want to take an assault on a marvelous device that is also a GPS map, also take notes whenever we think of things and we speak into it like we used to do with tape recorders when I was a traveling salesman and drove to Iowa every week. I mean, there's just things like that that we're incrementally attacking the privileges and the freedoms that we have. If we want to just assault cell phones, for crying out loud, let's just do it. Let's have that discussion. But this has become a carrier that kind of nibbles around the edges, and we're just going to introduce it a little bit at a time. To some people, that's a great political strategy. To some of us, we scratch our heads and say, wait a minute, what are we trying to do here? Because I know what AGC is looking for, and they're looking for enhanced safety in work zone, which we all want to do. But I would submit to you that before we layer on another law, like we've done, I don't know, 8 or 9 times since I've been here, that distracted driving is an offense. And indeed, the marquee tragedy that we held up to kind of bring this bill to forward had nothing to do with cell phones, everything to do with a slight distraction. And, oh, by the way, that driver was convicted because for distracted driving in that death, in that tragedy. So the law worked, folks. I don't know what else we're trying to do here except pile on or define even more. And having said that, I'm grateful that at least you've restricted your incremental step on cell phone use at least to when workers are present. And I think I'll conclude my remarks by reminding MnDOT in the audience and the AGC friends that there are several marvelous ways that we can enhance workplace safety and driver awareness that workers are actually present. And one of the things you got to do is keep your motoring public in mind. When we have a 9-mile-long construction zone and the first 7 miles have nobody present, there ought to be a different standard applied there. But when the workers are present and the signs are flashing and the LCD stuff is up saying workers are here 45 miles an hour, that's a different standard. And I think the distracted driving laws we already have on the books can work without layering another level of criminal offense on the motoring public. And I just got to tell you, I'm getting tired of more laws and more laws. But at the end of the day, what are we really after? We're really after workplace safety. And I think that Mr. Buchan's testimony the other day talks to the fact that there's some new technology out there, members, that we can put into play, and we don't have to put it in the statute book. They can put it in the rules, regulations, and design standards that we can accomplish exactly what we're looking for without impinging on the citizens' privileges and freedoms that they already have. And if they do screw up, then I'm all for throwing the book at them and getting them on a distracted driving charge, and I think that'll be the end of my comments.
Madam Chair, I happen to have finally found in the file here what the National Safety Council estimates that the 21% of crashes, or 1.1 million crashes in 2011, involved talking on handheld and hands-free cell phone. The model estimates an additional 4% or more crashes, or a minimum of 213 crashes in 2011 involved text messaging. That's a total of a minimum of 25% of crashes involve drivers talking and texting on cell phones. And what we're saying here is that's the leading cause of distracted driving. And that's what we've been saying all the time. So let's go to the one that is causing the most problems with distracted driving. Whether you're flying your plane, and I hope your plane is red, because when I'm flying mine, I want to give you plenty of room when you're multitasking.
Okay, Representative Earhart, I take it you want to recommend that House File 1796, as amended, be re-referred to Transportation Finance?
Yes, Madam Chair, I will do that because we don't have to go to wherever we were going before, civil law. We don't have the photocop in there. So I would make, do I make that motion? Is that a motion? I guess it is.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign.
Nay.
The motion is passed. And it will be. This will be going to Transportation Finance. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Schoen, would you like to come to the desk?
He's ready to roll.
Mine. Take him again.
Still get him.
Go ahead. I'm going to have to do it for
this. I don't know. Oh.
Good job.
Shall we wait for Ron? Yes. Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. Representative, I would like to move your bill, House File 2394, and recommend that it be re-referred to the General Register. Would you like to proceed?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And we can put a lot of brevity into this one. In state statute currently is a law that requires a deputy registrar to live within the county, so to reside within the county of where their business is. To my right is my constituent, Gary Spooner, who has been a private businessman down in Cottage Grove for decades. As my kids know him as Santa Gary. He is a professional Santa Claus, an award-winning one as well. So, yeah. True story. So, here's what happened. Gary wants to sell his registrar to a party that lives in Olmsted County. That party already owns registrars outside of Olmsted County. And when he went to make the sale with this individual, the state stepped in and said, oh, wait, we have this law that says you can't do that. We want to fix that. Gary's wife just retired, and she wants him to do a lot of stuff that would require him to retire as well. And we need to fix that, and I would appreciate your support.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Welcome to the committee, and would you identify yourself, please?
Gary Spooner. I'm the deputy registrar down in Cottage Grove, Minnesota, of course. On March 18th of this year, I'm going to be 75 years old, and I figured it was about time that I retired, and because I've had the deputy registrar office in Cottage Grove for over 40 years, and I do have a willing buyer, a man that I've known for quite some time, that is reliable and is well known. It always is, when you're looking for somebody to purchase your business, you always want somebody that you can trust and probably know that you're going to get it paid for it and you can retire. And that's what I plan on doing. And, of course, it gives me an opportunity to expand my Santa appearances and such, so I'm looking forward to that. And I'm looking forward to the retirement. Thank you.
Madam Chair, do you have the Mr. Chair, do you have the amendment?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to move the amendment to the 2394 that puts the enactment date up there. Get in front of the committee. Is the bill in front of the committee?
Yes. What? Yes. I'm looking for the bill. Can we move the amendment, which is what? Okay. Oh, A1. It's an A1 amendment written in there. So I see that. I will move the Representative Beard moves the A1 amendment. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? We now have the bill as amended before us. And where are we?
Mr. Chair, members, if there's any concerns, let us know. But you okay. Can't move a registrar. You can't. I mean, they can't even move across the street. So. That was the only concern I had with it, is to make sure that they couldn't buy this and move it out of our area. So it's a good business move, and it's good for our community. I appreciate your support, and we'll make this bill move fast right out of this committee.
Okay. Well, I would recommend that House File 2394 as amended be referred to the General Register. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. You're on your way.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Benson, where are you?
We had the road closed down. The guy comes flying through on his cell phone.
Well, he's not on this committee. He's on the other committee.
How was I supposed to see hand signals in this weather on my cell phone? True story.
Did anybody move that one when we were doing it? Okay. I would move House File 2266. You recommend it. I recommend that be referred to the Education Finance Committee. Go ahead, Representative Benson.
Thank you, Chairman, Mr. Chairman, and members. On February the 1st, a group of 11 bipartisan group of legislators. Representatives and senators from Southeast Minnesota attended a meeting with about 60 representatives representing 24 different school districts in Southeast Minnesota. And the purpose of it, of course, was to go over what their hopes and dreams for this legislative session were, and covered a myriad of topics from, of course, quality education and assessment processes and efficiencies, mandates, and so on. And one of the things that came up in the conversation was a desire to take a look at the requirement that is currently in statute that requires that individuals in school districts that drive Type 3 vehicles, and I'll go over what a Type 3 vehicle is for the committee, are required to retrain or take training for how to drive those vehicles on an annual basis. Their request was for us to consider changing that to for it to be every third year or every 3 years. For the members, Type 3 vehicles are passenger automobiles, including minivans and SUVs, station wagons, quite often like a suburban vehicle. But they have a requirement they have less than 10 capacity, including the driver, and they're a weight of less than 10,000 pounds. Also, in terms of Type 3 vehicle, in terms of what they're used for, of course, is to and from school for activities. They're employed by the school or a bus contractor. They only require a Class D with no endorsement. There is an annual license verification. There is a background that's required. Depending on who you are and if that's all you're doing is driving the Type 3, there could be a pre-employment drug testing, but typically if they're just coaches and staff, not. There is a requirement that the employee notify the employer of any incidents, driving incidents. There are certain offenses that the courts are required to report on. And what this bill seeks to do is not to change any of those things, any of the requirements that I just talked about. All this does is change the frequency of the training. Now remember, Type 3 vehicles are vehicles that are typically driven by these employees most of the time in their individual private lives already. So, I'm gonna allow for the superintendent of St. Charles to speak, and he'll identify himself for the record, to kind of give you some insight into what this will help school districts be able to do.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Mark Rubinick. I'm superintendent of schools in St. Charles.
Welcome.
Thank you. One of the things that we see as being a mandate that tends to get in the way of us at schools are the idea of annual recertification trainings with Type 3 vehicle drivers. As Representative Benson stated here, a vast, vast majority of these people that drive are doing one or two trips a year and are driving either an automobile or a minivan in our district and many of the districts around. For example, you might have a student or a couple students that qualify for a spelling bee, and the coach or the teacher that's coordinating that has to get those kids to, say, Rochester in our case. So for them to do that as a planned trip, we have to go through a training session with them each year. These people are teachers. They're sharp individuals. They're able to go through and to pick that up. But what it does is it puts a heavy burden on districts to, year after year, go through the entire program with that teacher. And you're talking probably, I would say, at least an hour and a half to 2 hours by the time they go through the training with the PowerPoint, the pre-trip inspection, the behind-the-wheel inspection that we do with them. And essentially what's happening then is they're driving once and they're taking one trip in a minivan or an automobile, and that's it. So we're expending a lot of time and energy on that. And from our perspective, these people, like I said, are very sharp individuals. They're able to carry through all of their things, and it just seems very, very redundant to us to have to go through that entire training. As Representative Benson said, they drive cars, minivans to school in their everyday lives. They deal with kids. They deal with rules and regulations. And this would be a nice change and a positive thing to help us save resources and a lot of time and energy that we put into this.
Are there questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rubinick, I got a question. I'm looking at this table, and I'm looking at see all these types of vehicles, A through D. Are a lot of the people that you are talking about that are driving any of the A through D vehicles driving the Type 3s?
Not very often at all. Once in a while, if we cannot find a driver, we might enlist one of our bus drivers. But typically, no. Anyone that we have, even in the small mini buses, I look at B or A, none of those meet the weight requirements, and as a result, they have to be going through a bus certification piece. So I'm talking about, again, automobiles and minivans in almost all the districts.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
And Mr. Rubick, just out of curiosity, in your own district, how many people are driving these Type 3 vehicles?
Right now, we had 31 the last time that I looked.
Oh, that's significant. I just wish that we could change our pilot training to every 3 years instead of every one, but that's a different story.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Yep. Well, Representative Anderson, if you promise not to multitask when you're up there, maybe we can do it.
Mr. Cherry's a pilot, so he's used to it.
Bring it up.
Are there other questions, comments? Well, I think, yes, Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't really have a question, but I just want to make a comment because, and I'm not going to support this bill today, but I'm going to explain to you why. I understand the intent behind it, and I understand that you're talking about trying to resolve a scenario where we're talking about one or two trips a year and expending a lot of time and energy to train these folks that you know may or may not do it. But I just want to bring your attention to this is not there's really no reason why we should or why we can or that we even dare to compare driving a car or a minivan back and forth to work and transporting someone else's children to and from some particular function. And if you look at, in the language of the current law, the training and what it includes, it's less about the size of the vehicle than it is about the transportation of these kids. And I'll just wrap up my comments and keep it short because I know we're short on time, but I'll tell you what, I don't want to be the one that votes yes to this and then has one of those drivers that we've reduced the frequency of their training get into an accident and then have the parents of that child come back to this committee or come back to me as a legislator and ask me why, because I don't have that answer as far as why. Right now, the only reason I see is for why is to make it easier for you and to reduce some of this time and energy that you don't want to expend. So for that reason, I'm not going to support your bill today, although I do understand why you brought it forward, and I'll just leave it at that.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to other representative testifier, this recent tragedy that happened with the Carlton Ultimate Team, do you know whether there was a Type 3 vehicle driver in that situation?
From what I understand, it was just the five students that were driving themselves.
Okay.
There.
Next question is, has to do with the inspection of the vehicle. If you move it back 3 years, as Representative Simonson said, are you still looking at the vehicles on a regular basis? And if so, what are those time increments?
All of our vehicles, anytime you transport students, those are inspected by the State Highway Patrol each year, and they have to meet code or standards that they have with that vehicle. Each trip, you know, when a person is driving a Type 3 vehicle, they have to go through their checklist, pre-trip inspection, all those things are spelled out. That's spelled out in the training. The training's very extensive. It does cover all of the different areas that are there, and they need to meet
Mr.
all
Chair.
Those things.
Representative Rosenthal.
Could you go through that checklist with me?
Can I go through that checklist with you? You want the checklist from the standpoint of what a driver has to go through to be certified? Okay.
On every trip that driver will take.
Well, I can't go through every item that's there. I mean, there's probably, I would say you're probably looking at least 35 or 40 different physical checklist pieces on a pre-trip inspection that they go through, and it's primarily doing under the hood inspection of fluids, water pump, fuel pumps, things like that. You're doing an outside inspection with all the mirrors, windows, tires, brake systems they require, they ask you to check into, and then you're looking for emergency equipment. It's a checklist that you go through each time that's in the vehicle that has to be gone through.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Robinick, Representative Benson, aren't we talking about the driver himself here rather than the vehicle in this?
Well,
bill?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, we are talking about the individual, but I think this Representative Rosenthal makes a very important point in actually helping to satisfy the issues that was brought up by the previous question, and that is they're getting the full training once every 3 years, but every time they drive this vehicle, they're going to be reminded of what they're actually learning. So it's not like, and you remember the preponderance of these folks are educators, very well-educated individuals, and so every time they drive the vehicle, they're going to be reminded of the things that they learned in training just simply by going through the checklist that's, you know, as has been stated, it's like 45 different elements that needs to be gone through. And they are handling students almost all day long. So, we're talking about people that get it, and I don't think we have to worry so much about whether or not they're going to forget the training. It's really a matter of, can we save them some time and opportunity to use that time in a different way in the education system by reducing the frequency.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hornstein? Oh, wait a minute. Representative Rosenthal.
Sorry.
Representative Rosenthal.
Steenthal.
All guys.
Representative or the testifier, this list of however many checks you have to do, where is it posted? Is it posted in the car? Is it on the driver?
Yes, there's a log that's in the car mm-hmm. each time that you have to go through. So when you have to take students out and drive with them, you have to sign into the log. You have to complete the checklist of the log before you're able to transport students and make sure that vehicle is a safe vehicle.
Okay. Mr. Chair, this is my last question. I tend to see how normal people drive these vehicles every day. I personally would not know a good gas pump from a bad water pump from a this or that. And I don't understand how a regular teacher gets that information under the training that you describe.
Mm-hmm. We have one more testifier, I think. I see on Jan Vanderwall is. I just want to make sure we get him up. He's not on my list, but Matt says we got to call him up. So, Representative Hornstein, do you have a question?
Well, we could do this after the testifier, but I would really like to hear from the State Patrol. Representative Simonson really got me thinking about some concerns on this bill, and I would like to hear what they have to say about it at some point. So maybe after this testifier.
Representative Swarovski, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, yeah. Thank you for the accolades of having intelligent teachers behind the wheel. And so, but I also I really appreciate your comments because it's gotten me thinking as well. And as a public school teacher, I know that this is an issue that is very time-consuming, an hour and a half. My question is, who does that training, and does it cost money, and is it on teacher time, like during direct instruction time during the day, or is it after work hours, and then are teachers paid for that? I'm just kind of curious on some of those things, that what are we expecting our teachers to do, or drivers, and then are they compensated for those, for their expertise that they are to deliver for our students?
Most of the training takes part outside of school days or school hours. So what we try to do is we try to do the classroom training during a workshop day at the beginning of the year for most of our staff. But as it appears during the year, that staff member has to go through training with the PowerPoint. Typically, that's on their time that's there. And then when we do the other stuff, then we would just make an appointment. You know, they might be go through their, I'll say their inspection, the pre-trip and the behind the wheel might be during preparation hour and after school hour before the day starts, depending on when they're available to do that. So.
Right. Mr. Chairman.
Benson,
yeah, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Swatsky, I did talk to Chairman of the Ed Finance Committee, and he's Representative Mark Wirtz, eager to take a look at it, sees the value in it, and many of the questions that you ask will have to be re-answered when we get to K-12 finance.
Mr. Vanderwall.
Mr. Chair, I'm Jan Vanderwall. I'm the transportation coordinator for Roseville School District. I am a person who does training in my school district for these drivers. I've been in contact through email with other transportation directors around the state, districts like Byron, Anoka, Hennepin, Hopkins, Sauk Center, Brainerd, Duluth, Rosemont, Apple Valley, Moorhead, and Roseville. We have all said that this is not a good idea. It was progress to have us to get training for all of our drivers every year. This is a step back from training every year, and I'll tell you why. In my district, we have about 85 drivers. I train them every year during workshop week. And every year, drivers who've been getting the same training every from the year before find out that they forgot things. And we tell them things that they've done during the year that we've heard during the year so that they get reminded of the right things that they should do. And sometimes that's because they didn't do them right. They are teachers, and they're coaches, and they're teaching assistants. And let me just say, some of our coaches come in and they coach and they do this, and that's all they do in our district because we can't just get all of our coaches from inside of our teaching staff. It's important, I think, that every year our drivers get reminded of what they're doing, and what they're doing is exactly what you said. They're carrying somebody else's kids somewhere, and if they lose one of those kids or all of those kids because they didn't get the training they needed that year, that's something that we all live with. And I lost a kindergartner one year in a regular school bus accident. I can tell you that was the worst day of my career, the worst day of my life. And we don't want to put that, I don't want to put it on your committee, I don't want to put it on that driver. That driver should have as much training as possible every year. The other thing we do every year as a part of this training is we assess them. We make them take a test at the end of our training to ensure that they have picked up the points that they need in order to do a safe job. I don't want to take up any more of your time. I think it's a pretty clear question to me.
Are you talking about rules of the road, you're training them, or mechanically how to fix the car if it has a breakdown? Which direction are you going, or are you doing both of them?
We start talking about training in terms of how do you drive safely, but we also talk about things like what do you do with kids while you're getting fuel on the vehicle? What do you do with kids? How do you drop them off? How do you pick them up in the course of the day? Do you know, with a regular school bus, you can stop and kids can cross the street. With a Type 3 vehicle, you stop so that the door that they get out of is on their side of the street. Or if they can't do that because of one-way streets, which happens in downtown Minneapolis, they have to escort the child across the street. You know, that kind of information. We do educate about pre-trip, as he talked about. We also do first aid training, and we even have in our training a thing about lockdowns and what to do about meeting an adverse person that might try to get onto the vehicle or might meet up with you and with a kid during the course of your trip.
Representative Petersburg, you had a question. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman. I have a school bus driver's endorsement, and so if any of the testimony testifiers or Mike can let me know, what is the current requirement for training in regards to standard school buses and all the other school driving?
Well, the standard training, I don't train any standard school bus drivers because we contract for service for those buses, but the standards are a certain number of hours, and I think Lieutenant Rue can be more clear on that than I can. He's more the expert.
because I'm aware that I have to take a test every 2 years rather than every 1 year. And so my question is are we holding a higher standard of need for training in regards to these vehicles versus our standard vehicles? And that's my question.
I don't believe that's so. I believe the drivers have to have training and multi-hours of training each year. And I know in our district, our contractor does at least 3 in-services per year, you know, which total up to more hours than what I'm talking about in terms of mine. They also have the higher standards of the drug test, and we also, you know, which is a random drug test, and we also have the physical required.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Chairman. As a follow-up question, I understand that there are a lot of people and a lot of companies that do extras in service. My question, I guess, is what is the law, what is the statute requirement that I'd like clarified?
The sheet that I passed out, the exhibit that I passed out, does show that driver's training for A through D school buses, the training is required on an annual basis.
Officer.
Mr. Chair, Brian Rue with the State Patrol, Lieutenant Director of Pupil Transportation. The members of the committee, Mr. Chair, that is correct. The large school bus drivers do go through a lot of the same competencies, the same requirements. They have to go have the same paperwork. It's just amended slightly for the versus the Type 3 or the large school bus drivers that they have to maintain in their files. Same thing as far as student management, proper loading, railroad crossings, driving, the pre-trips, and the behind-the-wheel assessment as well.
Representative Hornstein, you had some questions.
Thank you. Yeah, well, while the officer's here, Lieutenant, thank you. I would just want your perspective overall on the bill, and if you have any concerns about it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, members of the committee, we would prefer that the training and requirements remain consistent for all of our Type 3 drivers and school bus drivers. It is more than just how to drive the vehicle. Again, if you know the pre-trip form is there and you got to fill it out, great, but do you need to be reminded on, okay, you're looking at a tire, what are you looking for? What is the proper tread depth? Are you just looking to make sure that it's round and has air in it, or the lug nuts tight? Just a reminder on that, a reminder that you need to do the pre-trip. One of the requirements is knowing and understanding relevant laws. For those of you that have been in the Transportation Committee for a couple of years or even more now, realize that Type 3 changes do come through the committee frequently. So there are changes that need to be addressed with laws or regulations that the driver should be made aware of on a reoccurring basis.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, I guess having heard that and having heard that there is some disagreement among some school safety personnel here that we've heard, I would share Representative Simonson's concerns. I would be voting no at this point because I think the Department of Public Safety, the State Patrol, is a very important authority on this, as well as the other testifier. And I'm not sure, Representative Benson, how you get the yes, or if there's some more work that could be done, or compromises reached, or problem solving. But you know, at this point, I don't know if we want to lay this over or vote on it, but. These gentlemen, I think, make a compelling case, as does Representative Simonson.
Representative Anderson, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To our testifier, talking about training, I have to go through a lot of training. I understand what this is all about. And I also see pilots that, even over, depending if they're a captain with the airline, they've got to do it every 6 months. Does that make them even safer than a co-pilot that only has to do it every once a year? I don't think so. It's just that it's a law. It's a regulation. Safety is really not a factor. But my question to you is, you mentioned that you have an amount of people that come through after a year and they've forgotten the rules a little bit. And they come back and they have some training. Some of them fail that training. What happens at the point that they fail? I mean, are they retested? But I just want to know what the process is, and is there any way to weed out some of the bad apples from this? I just want to know.
We have retested, Mr. Chair, we have retested individuals and gotten them to be capable of of driving. We've also had some people who, through their actions, let's just say an accident here or there, maybe forgetting to do a pre-trip on an extended trip, where we have taken away the driving privileges because we felt that that was a safety issue. It's a question. What I want to comment on is when you say, well, it's just a requirement that you do something every year and that's why they do it. I think it's been, and I'm trying to remember, of course, I don't have statistics, just like the chair, but the way safety works is that you get trained, you're safe. The farther away you get from training, the less you're thinking about the safety issues. It needs to be brought back up to a safety level again. Then it's going to fall off, and it needs to be reminded. It's not something that just is. You're trained once, and you're good to go forever. And I can tell you there are some school teachers who are excellent school teachers, and they are lousy drivers. And that, you know, just because you're one doesn't mean you're the other. And that's what training is about, in addition to making sure they're reminded. It's also to weed out, although I can't tell you I've weeded out any teachers lately.
Representative Anderson.
Okay, that just strengthens my point then, because we've been told again that captains have to go every 6 months. So my argument to the lieutenant is, if that's the case, if once a year is good, maybe we should go 6 months. And I say that just tongue-in-cheek. But if we're talking safety and we're talking about kids, and it's always about the children, but there's always one trump card that trumps the children. It's called aviation accidents every single time. But now, okay, we're going to talk about the children here. Well, why wouldn't we go to a six-month thing if it is technically about the safety?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think a lot of people would probably agree. More training is always better. They didn't want to make it unduly burdensome to the school, but make it a yearly refresher. You know, get the updates, get the changes, and get everybody current again. And it's typically, as the superintendent implied, it's typically done at the back to school in service. Other than those few instances that come up short notice, where you got a new teacher, a new coach that's got to take a group, and then you get them in at that point.
We do our in-service, just as they were talking about it, during the teacher in-service at the start of the school year. We videotape it, and then if a new staff comes on, a new coach is hired for a spring sport, then they take that class, go through the class, the videotaped version of the class, and take the evaluation as it's done. We also, in the course of ours, is we have a driver handbook for all of our drivers, which the back of it is all of the rules, which is in every vehicle, and it gives the drivers that reminder too if they need to have a reference for what they should be doing while they're on the vehicle.
Representative Benson, do you have any concluding?
Thank you. I actually think that it's investment and risk, and you weigh both of those things, and you look at the standard that we have now, and I've been provided with no evidence that actually moving to having this training every 3 years is a compelling enough to not take at least a look at the amount of investment that the school districts are pouring into the training, versus the safety aspect. I'm under no delusions if I lay it over that we're in a time schedule and a calendar now that it's not going to get hurt again. I don't know that there's anything additional that can be done. It's just, there are many requirements on this sheet that are not going away from this bill. The only requirement they were asking for there to be a change in is for it to move to every third. I think the only modification that could be made would be maybe moving it to every other, since I heard that brought up with another training example. Which could be easily done. It could be done now, or it could be done on the fly. I've got to move it to Ed Finance. I really believe this was an opportunity to give those folks in the district some relief, and they could put these training dollars and hours in some other area. The older you get, I guess I am, the more often you got to go and get your driver's license renewed and all that. But, folks, we're talking about passenger vehicles that we drive every day. It's not lost on me that we're transporting other people's children. But I think simply moving the training out is not as destructive as we think it will be to the safety of our children. So the only thing that I could recommend, Mr. Chairman, would be that if we modified it to make it every other year, and then we could come back and review it to see if whether or not indeed there was any cause to believe that was a bad thing to do. That certainly could be done. I would imagine that Mr. Burris could make a on-the-fly change to it, since he's the person that put it together, and we could change that. That would provide some relief.
You want to amend your bill to say every other year, is that fit?
Every other year?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, yeah, I think if you're offering an oral amendment, I think it would read page 3, line 24, delete 3 years and insert other year.
So I'd move, Mr. Chair, that we accept the oral amendment, or you have to do that?
Well, I think we'll just incorporate that. Do we have to vote on that or not? All in favor of that amendment, please signify saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign?
No.
Okay. Well, I would suggest that was not adopted.
Mr. Chair, my desire then would be just to go ahead and vote on the bill, and it is what it is.
All right. All those in favor of that we recommend that House File 2260 be referred to the Education Finance Committee, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign?
No.
I believe that does not carry, and so we have it. It's in limbo now.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. Next. Representative Dorholt, I think. I don't know if we can do that one or not. Okay. What? Where does it go? you want to move your...
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move to refer House File 2255.
To the General Register.
General Register, yeah. This is the only stop.
Okay, go ahead.
This is for the ignition interlock program, which we, as a department bill, just incorporating some changes from what we had last year. So I'm here with me is Pat McCormick from the Department of Public Safety to kind of explain the efforts behind this.
Ah, welcome. We haven't seen you for almost a year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm doing well. Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Pat McCormick, and I'm the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services within the Division of our Department of Public Safety. And this is, as Representative said, this is a bill that DVS has moved forward through the department. In 2013, legislation expanded the ignition interlock program to require drivers that had an alcohol criminal vehicular operation violation, but not a fatal CVO, to enroll in the ignition interlock device program. And that goes into effect on July 1st of 2014. And to maintain consistency, DVS would treat the CVO-related canceled drivers the same as the non-canceled drivers by giving the driver a limited license for the first year of the program. So this particular bill is a technical fix that would give us explicit authority so that we could put the canceled CVO drivers on a limited license in the first year of the program. It allows for consistency in how we administer the program, and it also provides these drivers with the ability to drive for all essential activities related to employment, if they need to go to school or if they need to transport children. This allows them to do that on a limited license and with the ignition interlock device. And these are people that would normally have sentences where they would not have the ability to drive for a minimum of 3 to 5 years, even up to 10 years. So this allows them to continue employment, but they would be on a limited license and would have to meet the standards of having that limited license. And so we believe this would be allowing us to have consistent regulations and in our administration of the Ignition Interlock program, and so we ask for your support.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McCormick, good to see you again, too. If I remember this, we did this last year for employers for DUIs or multiple DUIs, but criminal vehicular operation, is that the differentiation here? Because if I understand, help the committee understand, remind us, I guess, the criminal vehicular operation has to involve injury or death, doesn't it? And so are you asking that to extend to this so that we can give that limited license so they can get on with their lives, at least be gainfully employed? Is that what we're doing here?
Mr. Chair and Representative Beard, yes, but it excludes people that have been convicted for CVOs that involve the death of a fatality. So it would include all other people that have CVO violations.
Okay, I just thank you. And I could see some of the question marks in some of the members' faces. Criminal vehicular CVOs, criminal vehicular operation, is not your run-of-the-mill, if I could say that, DWI. It actually involves injuring someone else, which makes it a crime right out of this, a different kind of a crime. And so that's what we're trying to accommodate. Thank you for clarifying that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Oh, Representative Andre.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wondering if, so are these automatically granted then, this one-year limited license, or would there be another process to define who is eligible for this? Or is it a wholesale, everyone can do it?
Mr. Chair and Representative Rumbeck, you would have to follow what the guidelines that are required by the department for ignition interlock. And so there are specific requirements that take place. You have to be monitored, and you have to go in and have your vehicle checked on a regular basis. I don't have those specific guidelines, but can get them to the committee if you want. But there's a regular monitoring of these drivers that takes place by DBS. We have a ignition interlock unit, and they are they're monitored, and they have to go in, I think, every 30 days to have that checked, to have that device checked, and to ensure they're meeting the requirements of the program.
Mm-hmm. Representative Neuberger? Excuse me. You have another question?
Well, Mr. Chair, I was wondering how many individuals are enrolled in the program at any given time.
Right now, there's 7,000 people in the program. What we're talking about here, in terms of the number of CVO violations that could be affected, would be about 650 individuals.
Thank you.
Representative Neuberger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McCormick, my question, I've got two here. Number one, my understanding, and just for refreshing the committee here, a car will not start with an interlock system. If you you have to blow into a device in order for the car to start, correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, that's correct. And then there are some rolling checks that also take place?
Will the car still, so the car will keep running unless you shut it off, correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes.
So if I leave work, I blow into the device, I start my car, I drive to the bar, put the car in park and leave it running, I walk into the bar and have a few drinks, I can walk back out to the car because it's still running, is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative, this isn't my technical expertise, but my understanding is that you would still have to restart the car, if I'm not mistaken. So.
Okay, well, Mr. Chair, thank you. I would like to have that clarified. I guess that's a small part of the questions that I have. I guess kind of bouncing off the theme for today with Representative Simonson, his concerns earlier. I see that this does not include if you've killed somebody, you're not eligible for this limited license. But if I drive my car into a crowd of people and four of them end up in nursing homes paralyzed from the neck down for the rest of their lives because they didn't die, I would meet the criteria for getting this exclusion. That's the way that I read this, and if that's the case, have you talked to any of the victims or family members of people who have been hit by these drunk drivers in the past who now have to spend the rest of their lives being spoon-fed in a wheelchair? Has there been any discourse with the victims of these people that some might say had the misfortune of not dying?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I specifically have not. I think that in general, you know, that we work with our Office of Traffic Safety, which is also within the department. And certainly, I think these things were discussed when this original bill was passed last year. And it was determined that this is a way you're still limiting their activities. It's basically getting to work, and then there's other things that would apply if you have children, like getting your children to the doctor or school, but you're not able to be driving other than for those reasons for that first year. You're on a limited license, so you aren't able to just drive wherever you want to. And those kinds of things that you're talking about, for instance, miles traveled, those types of things are monitored so that you would be able to monitor the driver and their activities in terms of if they're stopping for a length of time when they're supposed to be just using that driver's license. You're only allowed to drive to and from work. There's specific hours that are listed for many people, so that you can only drive during those hours. That's why we're asking for that first year to be the limited license and for us to have that authority to be explicit about it.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate your input. I can't support this at this time because correct me if I'm wrong, but the delineating factor here is if you drove your car and you hit someone and you killed them, you're not applicable for this limited license.
Correct.
But if I drive my car into a crowd of people and four of them end up as quadriplegics, even though they didn't die, technically I would still be eligible for this program, correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative, you could be. I would say that certainly there would be, you know, that we would have to look and see what the order was from the judge as well. That would come, the court order would make the difference, I think, in those particular cases. So,
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think before we move forward with this that it would be nice to hear from families of people who have loved ones or from people themselves who have suffered great, because as I read the bill here, it says great bodily harm. To me, that warrants a no vote.
Well, Representative Dorholt, make some final statements, if you will. We've got to get out of here. I'd like to move this bill if we...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, one point to Representative Neuberger, the rolling change, just to address, you can go park your car and leave it running, but when you get back in, they have continuing checks for the breathalyzers. I mean, and right. maybe one of the Troopers Association, correct me if I'm wrong, so you have ongoing checks. So if you don't blow into that when the little light starts beeping off, those guys come get you. Yeah. So just to make that straight. And this is a technical change. We discussed this quite heavily last year, and this would get people back to work. And I'm sure anybody who would cause that much damage and make poor people quadriplegics would likely be psychologically damaged enough to not get behind a wheel for a very long time.
Representative Runbeck, last question, because we've got to move, we got to get out of here. So.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question on the timing. So if I'm the driver in an accident which great bodily harm is done, say, last December, and here we are, March, I'm already able to, I'm in this program and I can have my license back. Is that correct? I mean, is there any, you know, is there a year in which you kind of are penalized for this by not having a driver's license?
Mr.
Chair and Representative Runbeck, as we talked about, you would have a limited license, and certainly it would depend on the conviction and any other order that would take place. But yes, you would have a limited license, and we would allow it to be for employment purposes and any other major necessities that you would need to have. For instance, if you have to take your children to daycare so you can go to work, those are the kinds of things that would be allowed under a limited license.
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, we're hearing, you know, other conditions to this program that don't appear, at least in this statute, and I think I would like to hear more, and it seems to me we would want to have some more definition, I think, to who is eligible. I would not be able to support this either.
Mr. Chair and representatives, I'd be glad to provide more information to you so you have more information of how we issue limited licenses and our authority. That authority is in statutes and rules, and so I could certainly provide that and some additional information on Ignition Interlock to the committee members.
I think that in view of the additional questions we and the offer, we should lay this over to the start of our next, whenever that is, next week?
Next Tuesday.
That's all right? Would everybody put their bills that we haven't taken up back into the folder so we have those? And with that said, we will adjourn.